I'm Camille Bichet. I will be a panelist as well as the moderator. To my right are Catherine Allred, Dr. Lucinda Bateman, otherwise known as Cindy, and Dr. Lauren Florence. We will be speaking in the following order. I will speak first, then Dr. Florence, then Dr. Bateman, and then Catherine Allred. I would like to introduce the panelists. I'll start in reverse order. Catherine Allred has described herself as a recovering anorexic. She is also a wife and mother. She also happens to be my oldest daughter. I'm enormously proud of her. She's extremely gifted with languages. She's also a dancer. I realized when she was 14 that she was a better writer than I am, and I had always considered myself a good writer, particularly since that's my field. She's extremely sensitive. I rely quite heavily on her opinion because she is a very good judge of character, so I always ask her what she thinks of any given situation or person because she always has something quite cogent to say. So I'm very interested to hear what she has to say about the subject of a young woman dealing with the issues of body image in this culture. Dr. Florence, I have been communicating with by phone for several weeks, but we just met this morning, and I am delighted to have made her acquaintance. She grew up in Salt Lake with, how many was it? Siblings you had?
I have two brothers.
Two brothers. All right. I had the impression that you came from quite a large family.
Oh, I have 40 cousins.
40 cousins. All right. Well, yes. Very large family in terms of the extended family. She graduated from the University of Utah, and then she went on to Southern California to get a master's degree in linguistics and was in the middle of her PhD program in linguistics when she decided that what she really wanted to be was a doctor. So she changed midstream to become an MD. What she realized was her real love after recalling as a child accompanying her friends to the school nurse whenever they got any scrapes and cuts and how exciting that was, and she wanted to be the one who was helping. It's been a very satisfying course, is that right? So linguistics is a very interesting hobby. She is now a plastic surgeon here in Salt Lake. She specializes in faces, malformation, reconstruction, and genetic problems with faces in particular. She is in solo practice. She is the editor and chair the editorial board of the Utah Medical Association, is that right?
Yeah.
You're also on the board of trustees. And she represents the women of the Utah women in the UMA. And she is now the secretary of the Department of Surgery. Is that correct? She has a very impressive bio. I'm not going to go further. I think she's also an excellent speaker. I'm always interested in the way people use language, and I had talked to her several times before I realized that she had a degree in linguistics, which explained why she was so well-spoken, something you don't always find in scientists. Dr. Bateman, I have always known as Cindy, so I'm always a little taken aback when I see her billed as Lucinda. Grew up in Provo and attended schools there at Provo High School. She went to BYU and studied biological science. She also got a master's in botany at BYU, and then she went on to Johns Hopkins Medical School. She returned to the University of Utah for her residency. I have always had a great deal of respect and admiration both for the mind and the humor of the Bateman family, and I have found that Cindy is a good representative of all the family abilities and gifts. She set up a practice in 1991 with three other women who are also general internists, and they have practiced together until last month when Cindy set up her own practice to specialize in fatigue consultation, particularly, as I understand it, women's health issues. Correct? Or not?
Not really, just fatigue consultation.
Fatigue consultation, but everybody I talk to tells me that she is the specialist in women's issues. So maybe that's not your specialty, but it's what you're known for. I also grew up in Provo, in the shadow of Y Mountain, as did Cindy. My father was a professor of organic chemistry at BYU for 40 years. Some of you may have taken classes from him. I remember some of you here from my growing up. Most people don't believe me when I tell them I grew up in Provo because they say I couldn't possibly fit there, and they're right. I never did. I lived in California for some time after I married and then returned to Provo a few years ago. I have 6 children. I'm divorced. I have 6 absolutely remarkably beautiful and amazing children, and I consider them both my greatest gift and also my greatest creative endeavor. And I take very little credit for how well they have turned out because they came to me absolutely amazing. I am a personal facilitator at present and an artist, a visual artist. Bodies, parts, and persons, image and identity in women's lives. The real issue here is how we deal with beauty. True beauty is about harmony. Individual human beauty is a manifestation of all aspects of a person: physical, spiritual, psychological, emotional, and intellectual. Both internal and external reality integrated into a whole self, a totality of personhood. The popular modern ideal of beauty is an objectification of a self. Beauty is taken out of the context of the whole, with physical appearance standing in for the whole of the real multifaceted person. The popular modern view of beauty, as presented by media, fashion, and cosmetic industries, has to do with physical appearance only. A person becomes only a body. Consequently, girls and women are profoundly negatively affected because very few fit the ideal model of feminine beauty. Their lack of or inability to conform adequately to this popular model results in an enormous loss of a sense of well-being, personal confidence, and inherent self-worth. I would like to share with you some pertinent thoughts, facts, and information. Cellulite, or cellulite, depending on how you pronounce it, normally occurs in humans and is not the next most evil thing since taxes. My youngest son's sleek, buff, 19-year-old swimming instructor has visible evidence of cellulite. 1 in 4 American females has an eating disorder. Breast implant surgery is the fastest growing area of plastic surgery. It has increased 306% since 1992 and 51% in just the last 2 years. The very surprisingly frank Relief Society president of the ward where my sister-in-law lived in Orem told my sister-in-law a couple of years ago that the majority of the adult women in the ward had boob jobs. Every issue of every women's magazine has an article on diet or exercise or both. How to make yourself more beautiful, more acceptable. Diet has ceased to mean in common jargon what it originally meant, simply what one eats, and has come to mean a way to improve oneself through carefully controlling what one does or does not allow oneself to ingest. Where did this prevailing ideal of feminine beauty, which has so affected our culture and the ways we view ourselves and consequently behave, originate? The modern ideal of feminine beauty is neither modern nor feminine. It has its origins in the classical Greek ideal of beauty, the semi-androgynous adolescent boy. Broad-shouldered, smooth-skinned, very slender, narrow-hipped, blessed with abundant hair. But, in the modern view, with breasts. Usually such breasts as would never be seen on such a body in nature. Few girls and even fewer adult women have such a body. I'd like to quote from Camille Paglia's, in my opinion, very misogynistic essay on pagan beauty. The Greek beautiful boy was a living idol of the Apollonian eye. As a sexual persona, the kouros represents that tense relation between eye and object that I saw in Nefertiti and that was absent in the Venus of Willendorf, with her easy, forgiving, spongy female amplitude. Zimmer correctly opposes heterosexual Hindu circulation of the blood to Greek aesthetics of the eye. The beautiful boy is a rebuke to Mother Nature, an escape from the labyrinth of the body, with its murky womb and bowels. Woman is the Dionysian miasma, the world of fluids, the Chthonian swamp of generation. Athens, says Campbell, was untouched by the vulgar seriousness of a heterosexual commitment to mere life. Yes, mere life is indeed rejected by the idealizing Apollonian mode. It is the divine human privilege to make ideas greater than nature. We are born into the indignities of the body, with its relentless inner movements pushing us moment by moment toward death. Greek Apollonianism, freezing the human form into absolute male externality, is a triumph of mind over matter. Apollo, slaying the python at Delphi, the navel of the world, halts the flood of time, for the coiled serpent we carry in our abdomen is the eternal wave motion of female fluidity. Every beautiful boy is an Icarus seeking the Apollonian sun. He escapes the labyrinth only to fall into nature's sea of dissolution. This view of ideal beauty is for women anti-nature, anti-female, anti-body, and anti-life. Freezing the human form into absolute male externality is not a triumph of mind over matter, but a separation of the self from wholeness and destruction of true personhood. This is objectification. Paglia makes a strong case against what is female. She uses terms of disopprobrium, spewing, chthonian, maw, swamp, murky, in reference to femaleness. This same ideal of beauty as seen in fashion magazines and shows like Ally McBeal represents only 5% of the body types in this country. And yet vast numbers of girls and women focus their time, energy, and money in an attempt to achieve that ideal with disastrous results to their health, both physically and psychologically. A few statistics bear out how much this ideal is sought after. The U.S. has a $33 billion a year diet industry, a $20 billion a year cosmetic industry, and a $400 million a year cosmetic surgery industry. I'd like to quote now from Naomi Wolf's very important essay, The Beauty Myth. During the past decade, women breached the power structure. Meanwhile, eating disorders rose exponentially and cosmetic surgery became the fastest growing medical specialty. During the past 5 years, consumer spending doubled. Pornography became the main media category, ahead of legitimate films and records combined. And 33,000 American women told researchers that they would rather lose 10 to 15 pounds than achieve any other goal. More women have more money and power and scope and legal recognition than we have ever had before. But in terms of how we feel about ourselves physically, we may actually be worse off than our unliberated grandmothers. Recent research consistently shows that inside the majority of the West's controlled, attractive, successful working women, there is a secret underlife poisoning our freedom. Infused with notions of beauty, it is a dark vein of self-hatred, physical obsessions, terror of aging, and dread of lost control. It is no accident that so many potentially powerful women feel this way. We are in the midst of a violent backlash against feminism that uses images of female beauty as a political weapon against women's advancement. The beauty myth. It is the modern version of a social reflex that has been in force since the Industrial Revolution. As women released themselves from the feminine mystique of domesticity, the beauty myth took over its lost ground, expanding as it waned to carry on its work of social control. The contemporary backlash is so violent because the ideology of beauty is the last one remaining of the old feminine ideologies that still has power to control those women whom second-wave feminism would have otherwise made relatively uncontrollable. It has grown stronger to take over the work of social coercion that myths about motherhood, domesticity, chastity, and passivity no longer can manage. It is seeking right now to undo psychologically and covertly all the good things that feminism did for women materially and overtly. We all want to look good and feel good about ourselves, but how damaging it can be when looking good is an externally imposed ideal designed to devalue and deny the nature of what is normal feminine. No real human female has the smooth, poreless skin, cellulite-free thighs, lush hair, non-existent hips, concave belly, and large, firm, high breasts of the images on the covers of fashion magazines. Those images are the products of extensive and expensive surgery and or computer manipulation and airbrushing. They are not real people. Women are real people. And yet millions and millions of girls and women starve and torture themselves in the hopeless pursuit of achieving that ideal image. What is at the root of all this striving and suffering? I submit that it is patriarchalism and capitalism, male institutions which slay both men and women in the objectification of the person and keep women powerless still, in spite of several generations of the feminine movement seeking to free and empower women. Institutions, especially deeply entrenched social ones, do not die easily. And the system we still have is still dependent on women's subordination and male dominance. The inadequacy of female flesh now stands in for the older inadequacy of the female mind. I am not demonizing men as individuals, but those institutions, those subtle and pervasive institutions dependent on male dominance, which have controlled the Western world for centuries and are still wielding and defining power. Women who are never good enough, never satisfied with themselves, and even many supermodels feel this way about themselves when interviewed, never adequate, are easily manipulated into spending lots of money to achieve an impossible ideal and never become whole and complete human beings. Advertising aimed at women works by lowering our self-esteem. If it flatters or builds our self-esteem, it is not effective. It does not drive us to punish ourselves and to spend more money in achieving an impossible ideal. As long as the definition of beauty comes from outside us rather than inside women, we will continue to be manipulated by it. Do not think that you are free from this if you are a man. Advertising is now beginning to target men, particularly young men, in the same way that it has women. And psychologists are now seeing a marked increase in the numbers of young men with eating disorders, which used to be almost exclusive to young women. We need a new way to see ourselves, and this needs to be something which comes from within us, not something which is imposed on us externally. We need to see ourselves as whole, as good, as adequate, just as we are. What sells is not making women feel good about themselves, but what makes them feel perennial, ugly, flawed, inadequate, ever seeking relief from a lack of self-esteem. I am naturally slender. I am not a person to really discuss problems of overweight, except for watching some of my friends deal with that. However, I recognize I am also unnaturally thin right now, due not from suffering from anorexia or bulimia, but because I have a chronic illness. I can't get fat. I can't grow boobs. I can't eat much, and I also do not assimilate well. But many women have envied me my extreme thinness. I do not regard it as healthy. I myself have suffered on and off for about 36 years over my lack of that most female physical attribute, breasts. I have often joked about the gift left me from that damn smart bee what stung me twice. However, with what I usually do not have, I have very successfully breastfed my 6 children, and I have come to realize that I too am a kind of victim of my own lack of a sense of physical beauty and therefore inherent worth, because I am built like an adolescent male. I envy those who have what I do not. We are all potential or real victims of an external and artificial definition of feminine beauty. None of my close female friends conform, even remotely, to what is the Western ideal of female beauty. They all appear exactly as nature made them in her infinite and exquisite variability, and they are all beautiful to me, very beautiful. All of my friends are whole individuals with bodies, parts, and passions. They are real people, and I love them for what they are, persons. I often think about a little girl, about 4 years old, who was in the lingerie department with her mother. My friend and I had decided that what we needed was to get something really racy to accept our bodies. This was about 3 years ago. So we went to a lingerie department, and we were trying on various things like fire engine red brassieres and lacy underpanties. And my friend had made an excellent selection. She is built exactly the opposite of what I am. She goes out where I go in, and she has what I call a voluptuous, lush female body, a gorgeous woman. Reuben would have adored her. So what she was buying was extremely appropriate for her body. For me, it was a joke. As my friend was standing at the checkout counter waiting to purchase her fire engine red lacy things, a little blonde 4-year-old walked up to her. Her eyes popped wide open. She gasped audibly, and then she turned to her mother and virtually shrieked, "Look! Look! I need those!" Her mother took her by the hand and tried to forcibly lead her away. This kind of indoctrination, I think, begins very early. I think it was wonderful that she recognized that those things were beautiful, and she wanted them. But we don't need something external to make us beautiful. We need to feel the beauty that is a core self. It's wonderful to adorn ourselves. Every culture, even the poorest, hunter-gathering cultures, adorn themselves in some way. It's not about what we do or do not wear. It's about what we do and do not feel about ourselves. It's not what we do and do not eat. It's what we think. I hope we can all stop dismembering ourselves and learn to reject what is not truly in our respective and collective self-interest. I hope that we can start seeing ourselves with new eyes and loving ourselves, beautifully created in the beautiful image of God.
That's masterful, Camille. Excellent discussion of these issues. And a good explanation to start with where I want to start is that we do live in a world where looks are important. We look at each other to tell as basic things as basic as, do you know the person? Or things as subtle as, am I going to like this person? And it's true. People may treat you better if you are pretty. So changing your looks can have far-reaching consequences. On the other hand, being too beautiful can keep a woman from getting an executive position, because we all know about the stereotype of brains and beauty don't mix. On the other hand, changing the outside can make you feel better inside. It doesn't have to, but it can. So, for instance, somebody has a large lump on the side of their face. We take that off. They have a new attitude about themselves. And that sort of illustrates my idea. There's a continuum. On the one hand, is things that definitely need to be changed, like six fingers. You are not part of our regular life if you have too many fingers, or a cleft lip, or a horrible scar. Those things obviously, and everyone agrees, should be changed. On the other end of the continuum, there are things that nobody can see except the person who wants to have them changed. So that brings up all the complex issues of what does it actually pay to change your outer self to improve your inner image? And when is making over a positive act of self-enhancement and not a negative statement of self-rejection? You can adorn and decorate your body, like you said, for a lot of reasons. To understand your own cosmetic conflicts, it's important to examine your underlying motives. Every time you're thinking about changing something, why are you doing that? To conform socially? To be like others? To fit in? Maybe out of fear of rejection or loneliness, or of fear of looking ugly, or for status? Sometimes changing your looks conveys social class and power. Or to create lust and longing in someone else, attracting attention and thereby possible sexual pleasure for yourself. Maybe you're changing yourself from pride to display your assets and show confidence. Maybe out of shame and insecurity to hide the flaws that you imagine or that are real, or to conceal your age. Sometimes we change ourselves to take aesthetic pleasure from the act of adornment. Maybe we just enjoy looking elegant or unique or outrageous. Sometimes it confirms one's femininity and displays one's gender role. And sometimes changing your look is for comfort, to relieve pain or annoyance, like reducing large breasts. They hurt. I mean, this is what I hear. To please others sometimes by conforming to the expressed wishes of a loved one. I do it for someone. Our personal cosmetic motives and our conflicts about those reflect the way society has taught us to look at beauty and at our own bodies. Women walk a fine line between looking attractive and looking seductive. We may gain power on one side of that line and lose power on the other, or vice versa. We're constantly faced with the challenge of updating our attitudes to cosmetic changes because fashions change. Sometimes hemlines are up and down, necklines go up and down, brows go from pencil thin to shaggy thick, lips go from glossy bright to ghostly white. Our strong need to fit in socially requires a constant update in self-presentation and a corresponding change in body image. When fashions change, we have to figure out how we should look. Then there's also tremendous commercial pressure. We are pressured constantly to revise our cosmetic routines and experiment with new products. The people who make money on cosmetic products have a vested interest in us buying a lot of things. If we constantly change our looks, they benefit financially. If we have to hate ourselves to buy a lot, well, then they don't really care about that part. All they want is for us to buy. We have many options to change ourselves these days, of course. We can put smoothers on our skin, colors on our skin, on our lips, on our eyes, eyelashes, hair. You can change the shape of it, thicken it, take all the hair off the rest of your body, take the fat off the upper eyelids, a little tightening up of the neck, take fat from everywhere all over your body with liposuction, raise, enlarge, flatten breasts, flatten tummies. This is all available. And of course, none of us do all these things, but few of us do none of them. We pick and choose what we think is needed to fit nicely into our own social scene. We know the rules of our own group. We instinctively know what's required of us. We need to get clear on the motives of what's required of us. Are we making changes to our bodies because that's going to make us like ourselves more, or because someone else is going to like us, or because we hate ourselves? Why are we changing? This is a very personal and a very complex question. Body image develops in childhood. How we were looked at, praised, criticized, that stays with us. We were socialized to see ourselves through the eyes of our family and our culture. Now, most girls are encouraged to dress up and show off. Girl watching is a national pastime. And few of us are consciously aware of this objectification all the time, or very concerned about it. It just happens. After all, it's nicer to be looked over than overlooked. But objectification encourages you to see yourself in terms of parts and to transform those parts to gain attention. So here are a few questions I want you to ask yourself just kind of run a check to see if you have body image problems. Are you frequently self-conscious about your appearance? Do certain body parts tend to dominate your thoughts? Do you compare yourself often with women or other women or other or media models? Do some body parts seem dramatically different from one day to the next? And do people say you look better than you think you do? If you answered yes to any of these questions, there's a suggestion that maybe your body image is distorted in a negative direction. And you could benefit from reevaluating your own image in your mind and learning to care for yourself in a new way. Caring for your body starts with getting in touch with it. Pay attention to your physical needs. Eat healthily and exercise for health. Begin to trust your body and know that it knows what is best for it. It'll tell you how to nurture it. It'll tell you when you're hungry. Eat when you're hungry. And appreciate the pleasures that your body can inherently provide. Then accept your limitations, because everyone gets only one body, and most people think that it has imperfections. But you only get one. Know that that's the one you have. Nurture your ego, pamper your pride, and remember that trying to look your best isn't hating your body. Making healthy cosmetic decisions that help you love yourself is complicated, however. Playing with your image can be fun. Cosmetic packaging can allow us to go from being merely female to being marvelously female, but it's motive that you have to remember. And as new cosmetic technologies are perfected, the surgical route to beauty becomes more and more tempting. It's just out there and easy. Surgery does offer many advantages, and they were previously unavailable. But it's an option that also creates greater conflicts because it's permanent. You dye your hair, it'll grow back. But if you have something cut, it stays that way, and it can be dangerous. Complications and even deaths occur in all forms. Every form of cosmetic surgery has problems. Potential hazards include infection, nerve damage, anesthetic reactions, unusual scarring, blood clots, asymmetry. The average facelift patient has reportedly dropped from 60 years old to 50 years old. And many 40-year-olds are now having surgery. The bust alteration business is booming. In one recent year, 150,000 breasts were lifted, implanted, or reduced. In the 70s, a wave of feminism swept in the small-breasted look, and in the 80s, that went away with family values, and we're back to large breasts are better. So what you have is always going to change. But does cosmetic surgery work? Yes, it does, generally, in the same way that makeup works. Most patients are pleased with the results. I mean, maybe they're pleased with the results because they have to be, because they went through it and now that's no choice. But they report that they look better after surgery, and they report that they are seen more socially desirable in other ways after this surgery. Cosmetic surgery can accomplish some things, but not everything. It's not magic.
It won't radically transform your personality or instantly deliver new love. If you expect miracles, you're likely to be disappointed. It can enhance appearance and help you like yourself better sometimes. The surgical route is one way to help you love yourself. The potential costs and risks of surgery are relatively high compared to other methods. In summary, sometimes beauty transformations are worth it and sometimes they're not. In facing your own conflicts about making over, remember these points. First, assess your motives. Why does a change seem so important now? Consider the underlying factors that may be influencing you. Perhaps you're seeking a cosmetic solution to problems that could best be handled in other ways. Take small steps in revising your beauty routines. Make them fun, flexible, sensuous. Look for alternatives that are less costly and less painful. Try to use the process of adornment to nurture and enhance your body image, as well as the one you see in the mirror. And consider the long-term effects. Will it improve your image, your body image in the long run, or is this just a short-term distraction? And recognize and resist commercial messages. There's a constant pressure on you to buy beauty at any price. But you alone will profit when you make over your body image from the inside out. I guess I'll come up here even though I might not be able to see over.
I'm going to deviate a little from the form in which my first two sisters have spoken and be a little bit personal and informal. I hope you'll forgive me for that. And as I was preparing for this, actually at Camille's request on the phone, I divided it a little bit into my personal experience and my professional experience as a physician. So I would like to share some of my thoughts with you. Also, before I started, I wanted to just say that the word beauty, as all words in English, can have so many meanings that I'd like to be kind of careful about how we talk about it. And certainly beauty can describe, it's sort of like when we talk about being happy versus having joy in our culture. And we know that joy is a very full, deep, many-dimensional word with full of a variety of emotions, and we think of being happy as being a little bit superficial. I'd like to talk about beauty. I think beauty carries all of those meanings in relation to all of those dimensions. And so what I'm going to be talking about is the more superficial kind of beauty, the more external or what we think everybody will accept when we're talking about beauty. So let me share a little bit personally about my own, what I consider my journey with beauty in that sense, my personal journey. When I was young, these are the things I remember worrying about. Having red hair and freckles. I hated it because people always mentioned it. They always brought it up. It made me different, and there was a little bit of condescension in their voices, or a lot, depending on the person. I think that I compensated for that by trying to get as tan as possible so that my freckles would all blend together and look like a tan. And, of course, it just, as my mother always said, made me look one color. The other thing I remember is needing to have smaller feet and wearing too tight of shoes all the time because I thought big feet were bad, and following the example of my mother in that, and also wearing my pants too tight around the waist so that I would think I was, and just so tight they were always uncomfortable so that I would look smaller. And the other thing is I remember I sort of gave up on being beautiful in the face except for one thing, and that is that I wore mascara, and that was my little handhold on being beautiful because I had long eyelashes and people always mentioned it. If I wore a mascara, maybe it would draw attention from everything else about me and people would concentrate on my eyes, which I thought maybe could be close to beautiful or at least as close as my sisters, my two sisters. I just have to say something about sisters as I deviate from this. I was talking to a friend yesterday as I was preparing this, someone I think, a woman who I think is very, very healthy in terms of her attitude about her physical self. She wears anything from nothing to everything, from grungy to fancy. She could dye her hair. She could have a tattoo. She could be, you know, she just has that ability to feel comfortable being outrageous in any way. And I said, you know, how did you get like that? You know, what a wonderful thing to have that kind of a self-image. And she said, are you kidding? My older sister was knocked down, dead, gorgeous. And I decided there was no way I could ever do that. So I had to do something else. And so in reality, she developed that kind of a personality because she gave up ever being beautiful and competing with what real beauty was. Maybe she came out okay in the end, actually. Anyway, so in terms of those physical characteristics, I think the most difficult one for me was always a sense of feeling overweight. And as I look back, and I've had periods in my life as an adult when I've been very overweight, at the time I began worrying about that, I wasn't overweight. And most of the time in my adolescence, I wasn't overweight. But I always thought I was overweight, and I spent a good portion of my life, maybe half of my growing up days, with the perception that I was on a diet. And I can remember all the diets I did with my sisters and my mother. I also know that I never learned how to exercise or use physical activity to maintain my weight until I was close to being an adult. I learned to be more physically active maybe in my latter years of high school and college, but I never used it as a tool to maintain my weight very consistently until I was an adult. I also had periods of time when I was young, not even that young, I think up through college and even later, when I had very poor control over my eating. I would binge eat and eating would consume my thoughts. I also had experience of trying to make myself throw up when I was younger. I think I did it about 3 times. So that I thought, well, yeah, I've heard about that. Maybe that's the way I can get rid of this. And sometimes when I overate way too much, I would make myself throw up so that I could not pay the price of eating that food. Never became an illness behavior for me, but I can say I understand the thoughts that take someone in that direction. I thought it was too icky. I hated it when it went up my nose. Anyway, there were a couple of landmark times in my life where I made some changes from what I consider to be not the most healthy, but probably consistent with my age kind of approach toward my physical body. And the first came when I was a missionary in the MTC, which is something like analogous to boot camp. And 2 things happened to me there that were actually completely opposite. The first was that I had to attend, it was mandatory for all sister missionaries, to attend what was called Personal Development for Lady Missionaries class on Wednesday nights. And in that class, we were taught how to be more acceptable physically so we could go out and represent the church. And I was going to read you a portion from my journal that I wrote while I was in the MTC at this time. And you have to understand, I am a doobie. I was the perfect missionary. I was the perfect student. I was the perfect, most obedient person there was in every respect, including every part of church activity. And I went to the sisters' development class. I was sitting on the front row, as I always do, and there were 3 women up there. I left out their names. They were in my journal. I remember who they are now, who were up there with makeup and things to teach us how to make ourselves up. They weren't teaching us how to do what I would consider the other kind of beauty, joy analogy. And because I was on the front row, they looked around to see who their victim could be. And to my dread, as they were looking for someone to sit in the chair in the front, they grabbed me and put me up there because I have the bushiest eyebrows. I always thought I did anyway. Now they're in, by the way. I think they're going out again. Anyway, they stood me up there, and she did a demonstration on plucking eyebrows and plucked one of my eyebrows in front of the entire group. So in that context, I want to read for you my journal entry that night, July 10th, 1980. Yesterday we had personal development. Notice the back and forth. I'm trying to say something positive, and then my feelings come through here. Yesterday we had personal development, a program exclusively for the sisters. We tried on makeup and analyzed our faces. It made me very frustrated when she plucked my eyebrows. I know they look better tweezed, parentheses, in some people's opinion, but I don't like being bothered. I'd rather decide to tweeze my own eyebrows, thank you. Then I wrote, between the pain of having half my eyebrow ripped out and my upsurging frustrations, I was near tears. But to save face, I swallowed my pride and submitted to the workover. And then I had to go pluck my other eyebrow when I got to my room. They can make me do it once, but they can't keep me doing it. Then I put in parentheses, yee-hee-hee. Sigh. I might consider keeping my eyebrows mowed, but I refuse to use foundation and eyeshadow. I don't have time to spend an hour getting ready every morning. Lightning may strike me, but I wonder if this program, as it is now, is what the Lord would have his sister missionaries doing in the MTC. Now that deserves applause. Anyway. So, on the one hand, was this experience of having a spiritual place tell me I had to pluck my eyebrows and I had to wear a foundation and eyeshadow to go out and be a good missionary. I'm not criticizing the church. This is just something somebody thought up that 2 years or that time in the MTC, and it's a reflection of our attitudes about what women should do to be beautiful and how we could improve the image of dumpy sister missionaries or whatever it was that was on someone's mind. On the other hand, I have this lifelong impression of a specific day in the MTC. And I opened the closet door and looked in the mirror. I will never forget this moment. I remember thinking, wow, I am me. I am my soul. I am not my outside self. And the reason is I had cut my hair for the first time in my life because it was required in my mission. I had long hair my entire life, and I cut it as short as a boy's. I did it so I wouldn't be forced to do it when I got there because my mission president demanded that. I had an entire set of new clothes in my suitcase, as missionaries always do. I had a new companion. I lived in a new place. I had an entirely different set of books. I had two new blank journals. And every single person I associated with, a person I'd never seen before. And I was speaking a new language, and I wasn't allowed to speak any English. There was not one single thing left of me but my skin and my soul. And I remember looking in the mirror, and that was not a devastating thing. That was an empowering thing. And all of a sudden, I realized that that was all that mattered. That combined with going to a new country, seeing a whole new culture where people valued different things, and understanding that the things that we value are pretty ephemeral, and they make it, and they're different from place to place, gave me a whole new outlook on life. I also noted that during this time, my weight, I'm going to just tell you my weight. That's another thing. Women aren't allowed to talk about their weight. I'm 5'2", and I remember I'd finally topped over 130, and I was about 132 in college. And when I went into the MTC, I made a goal during the 2 months to lose weight, and I did it by eating right and exercising, and I got down to 122. Just the fact that I can remember these numbers says something about my obsession with this. When I was on my mission, I stopped paying attention to my weight, but I didn't give up my eating habits or do any exercise, and my weight during my mission increased to about 145. Which is a pretty big weight gain for someone who's 5'2". When I came back, I fixed that and got rid of it. The second time in my life when I had a big change in my body image and the move away from what I'd been conditioned to was during medical training, especially my internship, when suddenly my life, 24 hours a day, was dealing with people who were ill or dying. Suddenly those other things take on very little importance, not to mention the fact that I was exhausted and didn't have time to do anything. This is when the mascara went. I had to decide if I wanted my eyes to be red and angry and painful in the morning when I got up versus be two different people. And I remember that. I would have two identities, my made-up identity, my long eyelash, beautiful eye identity, and my just-got-up, disappeared, small beady eyes identity. You feel like two different people. Those of you who've worn eye makeup know that you feel like two different people. And I decided I did not want to be two different people around all the people I worked with. I said, I got to give up the on or the off, and I gave up wearing mascara, and I never went back to it. The other thing that left were shoes. My shoes got wider, longer, and flatter. And I stopped wearing heels because my feet hurt all the time because I had to be on my feet. And my clothes got looser. I stopped wearing tight pants. During the next few years of my life after medical school, I did several experiments with, I was constantly thinking about this problem of my, not an obsession, but too much time spent paying attention to my weight. I decided I was going to stop thinking about it. I'm just not going to think about it. I was not going to go on diets. I was not going to worry about it. Everybody said, if you stop obsessing about it, you'll be fine. Well, guess what? I gained 30 pounds. 35 pounds. I topped out at 165. And the reason is, I forgot to give up overeating, obsessive eating, and I forgot that I needed to be physically healthy and to exercise on a consistent basis. I wasn't quite willing or didn't have a... I was in denial about those things. Finally, when I was about 38, and I hope I can stay here, I gave up most of those things, and I now exercise consistently. I mean, I ought to practice what I preach. I mean, I've been a doctor for 12, 15 years. I'm doing much better. I don't think about my weight so much. I eat better, and I exercise all the time, and I don't obsess about it as much, although I do have to think about it. And the very fact that I brought it up here in this talk shows that it's still a prominent and asymmetric part of my life that I even have to think about it. Now, I also wanted to share with you some observations before I summarize about my work as a physician and my observations about patients. And this is going to be a direct comparison between male patients and female patients in my office. And I have a fairly equal number of both. I don't think I have ever had a male patient comment on their physical appearance or beauty in the office. Now, we may discuss their weight, but that's different, and it doesn't get done in a context of apology. But I can tell you, and I made a list of what women say to me as their physician while I talk to them and while I examine their physical body, usually while I'm doing my physical exam. The first is face and skin. Women are very self-conscious about their skin and their face. I say skin is sort of an extension. It's the visible part of our skin. We all know that. That's what we do plastic surgery about, how big or small their breasts are. Second is their stomach. They usually say, they make a comment about how fat their stomach is, and they hold it in so that it doesn't stick out while I do my exam, meaning they're paying attention and they're self-conscious about where their stomach is and how big it is. They comment about their hair. I'm sorry I didn't shave my legs. Well, my dear, that's where hair grows. I mean, I really don't care in the doctor's office. People apologize for not shaving their legs, and they make comments about their hair. And especially women are self-conscious if they have more hair than the average woman. And that's a little different thing than making a comment to me. Almost every woman says something about their feet. My feet are ugly, is what they say. It's almost always the same thing. I have the ugliest feet. Women won't be weighed in the office, or they make a comment about being weighed, or they complain about being weighed in the office. Oh, your weight is a medical number, but everybody comments about it. Women comment about odors, about their breath, about the way their arm smells, and about the way their groin smells during the exam. They verbally make some disparaging or apologetic comment. And they apologize for sweating, which is a natural physiologic process. They always apologize. I'm sorry my armpits are wet. I'm sorry I have sweat on my chest. Now, all of us do this. I know one of you has done it. And not every person says all those things. But it is so common that it's an expected thing when I examine people's bodies, and it almost never occurs when a man is examined in my office. Now, that is something very profound to me about the way women feel about their bodies. They're either self-conscious, well, they are self-conscious, but they apologize to me while I'm examining their bodies. As a physician, I am so grateful that I have had the opportunity to examine thousands of bodies, because for me, the mythical body no longer exists. We all have that ability to look around us and see that women do not have the mythical body, but somehow we can be in more denial. As a physician, I see people with their clothes off and I examine their parts, and there is no norm for the size of breasts or the shape of breasts. The diversity and the change is incredible. It's hard to explain because no one has the opportunity to see that diversity except a physician. And the other weird thing is everybody's feet look alike. Feet all look the same, those ugly things. So I think a doctor is given the gift of awareness of a diversity that dispels the illusion of that perfect female body. And I'm grateful for that because it's helped me a lot. And sometimes I can pass it on to my patients, although I'm not sure they believe me. Just a couple of things before I close. One is, I wrote down what I thought were the dangers of obsession with physical beauty. First is maladaptive behaviors, meaning developing an eating disorder, becoming anorexic or bulimic, engaging in extreme diets or exercise that are dangerous, taking drugs that are dangerous, engaging in risky surgical procedures, and particularly having it feed into mood disorders, obsessive, depressive, anxious mood disorders. Those are prevalent maladaptive behaviors that women have to deal with and have to undo from the time that they grow up and to when they get into adulthood, if they're able to do it. The second is neglecting the development of their self or their soul. I was thinking last night that when I was growing up, I had this idea of developing my inside self and my outside self. You know how we talk about that? You're beautiful inside and beautiful outside. Well, your inside self and your outside self are not parallel at all. Your inside self does this. You think about the growth and development, we all understand, from the time you're young to the time you're old. We consider it a stepwise thing. You mature, you blah, blah, blah. And everybody does that to better degrees. Beauty is not parallel to that. The kind of beauty we call beauty is very much something that peaks when you... I wrote in here, I called it the mating plumage mode, where you know, in the animal kingdom, you get on your colorful feathers and everything so you can find your mate. Well, there's a thing about this is that men also peak around that time, and then they go on and do their inside development. They get a career, they become smart, they do all those things. And what happens to women is sometimes, and I don't mean to generalize, but we reach that peak, the mating plumage, and then, you know, get married, have children, and then guess what? Somehow that we've thought that that is our course of development, and everybody tries to hang on to that beauty, when in reality what you have to do is find out what the other beauty is, the joy. Really, that outward progression is aging. That goes with becoming mature on the inside is your physical body aging, not trying not to age. And so beauty to me would be appreciation for the physical body aging in the same way that we appreciate our emotions and our intellect maturing. But women, for some reason, get stuck in that place where they think they have to stay 20 in the way they look. And it's a shame. And I think the women most likely to be able to overcome it are women who find a very strong way to develop their sense of soul and self and are able to develop who they are and gain perspective to outweigh that other value and put it behind them and seek after the other beauty. The last thing I wanted to say is that the other danger of obsession with physical beauty may be, it's hard to explain this, but what I think is an all or nothing attitude about physical appearance. And that is, and I see it medically, that is you hang on to your perception of beauty until it's no longer possible, and then you just give up and let yourself fall apart physically. Get out of shape, you know what I mean? When in reality, what we ought to replace beauty with is physical health. And because that you can hang on to forever, a good portion of physical health, except the things that you don't have control over. So if we could reframe and not give up fitness and health when hanging on to a youthful beauty matures into age-related changes. Anyway, those were my thoughts. And I want to say in closing that I think it's a very complex issue. I appreciate so much the things that have come before. Beauty, in all of its definitions, is important. Our self-image is important. Our sense of self is important. And it's okay to... Here's what I wanted to say, that beauty is not maturity. Beauty is not right or wrong, and beauty is not a measure of worth. Beauty, in its superficial definition, is like a personal choice or a gift. It's like being musical or like being intellectual or like being athletic. Some people are born with it and we adore it. And other people can work really hard at it and get it. But not everybody has to have it. And it would be nice if beauty could be relegated to that kind of a quality and not become synonymous with maturity.
Forgive me if I speak fast. I kind of have to go to the bathroom and drink too much water. I kind of viewed my position on this panel as, I guess my job, I think, was to kind of give a really personal overview of this and the way society's image of beauty has been communicated to me in my personal experience. And I thought, that's going to be a snap. You know, I don't have to do any research for that. I just basically talk about what my experience has been. And, oh my hell, I don't think I've had an assignment this hard in years. I've written several research papers about this, not several, but a few, in college and high school. And so I thought, you know, I have a really good background for this. And I've known about this panel for a while, and I can't tell you how hard it has been. It's just been incredible to me. That's what I'm most amazed about. I guess I have to say that I do buy into that whole beauty and fashion scene. I subscribe to several fashion magazines. I love fashion design. I love dressing well, I guess you could say. And at the same time, I chastise myself for that because I grew up with this fairly liberal feminist mother. My sisters are rebellious when it comes to typical fashions and beauty, you could say. And so I have guilt about wanting to be beautiful. And my mom was appalled when she found out about the magazines that I subscribed to. But I love these magazines. I save them. You know, I love the art form of fashion. I think one of a major reason for me that this was so difficult to talk about was because society's images of beauty affect us so profoundly unconsciously. We're flooded with these images, and they're completely non-rational. Not irrational, but non-rational. Nobody tells you this. You just see it and ingest it, or at least I did. And so it's really difficult to go back and make conscious what has already been so unconscious. One of the main things I decided to do is go back to my teen years, because that's, I think, when I was affected most by external images of beauty. Today's media, especially advertising, is constantly dictating to us what we should be, what is normal, and what is ideal. Then we are told that we can become that way through buying and using certain products. While everyone is affected by this, it appears to me that teens are particularly so. Perhaps I don't have a very good perspective on that, because I'm only 21, so I haven't been slotted into any other age demographics. As a teenager, one is constantly trying to figure out. And this is kind of funny. As I was writing this and thinking about what I was going to say, as a teenager, I remember hearing people say things like this. And I always swore that I'd never say this. People were always telling me, oh, it's so hard to be a teenager. I'd never go back and relive those years. And I was like, man, you know, I'm not going to be that way. Being a teenager, it's no different, you know. And as I look back on it now, it's like, how did I live through that? Holy shit. Old meanings that seemed relevant as a child are completely wiped out or turned on their head. They're changed. Contexts completely change. I remember ads as a child. I didn't even know. I guess I noticed them, but they didn't mean anything to me. Suddenly, they seem personally relevant. There's something all of a sudden new telling me what I had to be. And suddenly, it was a very personal thing. It became really bad to be different. That was communicated to me pretty clearly. So, yeah, we're told profoundly it's bad to be different. What you're supposed to be is this. And this normalcy that we're presented with that is embodied by 5% of the population, it's literally almost impossible to achieve. And I was blessed with a very skinny body genetically. And I always had friends in elementary school telling me, in elementary school, fourth grade, that they were so jealous that I was so skinny. And I was actually really embarrassed about being so skinny because I would never wear dresses or shorts that showed my knees because I thought they were too bony. But I realized very early on that it was valuable to be skinny. So I guess there I was in junior high school trying desperately to fit in, trying to make myself like my peers, and at the same time trying to hang on what was important to me as a child. I was anorexic in high school. The first signs showed up maybe in sixth or fifth grade because I had no time for breakfast. I didn't think I was fat. I'm too self-indulgent to lose weight that way anyway. But I was anorexic because of the control it appeared to give me, although I was never that articulate with myself about it at that time. Looking back, I realize now that I felt like I had very little control over most areas of my life, and without thinking about it, food seemed like, and was in one way, one thing that was very easy to control. Anorexia was a sin of omission. All I had to do was not eat, not pack a lunch, not have time for breakfast. The only thing I had to deal with was feeling hungry, and it wasn't hard. It was easier not to eat. I mean, obviously it's not as simple as all that. There are a lot of issues that went into it, but that was part of it. And another part of it was self-loathing, not because I was fat, but because in other ways I didn't fit in, and it was a self-punishment thing. The irony of that is that probably the thing I had the least control over was my eating. I guess I'll come back to the anorexia. I was told at a young age, very subtly, that power lies in beauty. That if you're beautiful, you can control people around you. They'll worship you. They'll adore you. And part of that is objectification. My place is to be an object. I'm kind of sick of these arguments that I get from feminists growing up. You know, I got so tired of hearing feminists complain about the objectification of women. And I didn't want to rag on that in this. But I realize it is still a major problem. It sort of seems like that should be something we should be over with by now, since the feminist revolution has been around since the 60s. But if anything, there's been a backlash to that. I hated the objectification that I felt when I was with people and I was beautiful and they'd compliment me, and I realized that they weren't complimenting me for anything internal. It was strictly external. And I realized that a lot of power came from the guy that I was with, and the way I got a good guy was by looking really beautiful. I wasn't completely shallow. There was a huge dichotomy in me. On the one hand, I really wanted to be powerful through that beauty. On the other hand, I despised that kind of way of getting power. When I was 14 years old, I had long hair that was... It was dyed red, but it looked natural, and I got a lot of compliments for my red hair. It was a big attention getter. And I realized that it had come to define me as a person, that I had let my beauty completely define me. And so in an act of utter rebellion, I shaved all of my hair off. That was an extraordinary thing to me. It had some results that I hadn't completely expected. People who I'd been friends with since elementary school totally dropped me. Nothing else changed about me except that. It wasn't that they thought I was too weird for shaving my hair, but it was just such a radical change, and it completely rejected their ideas of ways that girls should be, that close girlfriends from elementary school just quit having anything to do with me. And other people in my school social situation wanted to be friends with me. And I thought how totally odd that these people would choose to associate with me strictly because of my looks. And that changed a lot about who I became. I learned that through various experiences, I started watching what happened when I would go out in public. When I wore makeup, people treated me very differently from when I didn't. I remember going into department stores one day, and people would ask me if I needed help. They would offer services and things like that. On days that I was wearing makeup, on the next day I would go back not wearing makeup, and nobody would offer me help. Nothing would happen. I don't think I look that different when I'm not wearing makeup, but it was a really, really radical change. And I don't know, perhaps some of that was subconsciously I acted different, but I don't think it was very much. Something else I wanted to address was the LDS church, since that's pretty much the only church that I have very much experience with, and how that's affected my ideas of beauty. When I was a beehive, 12 years old, just in women's, the second activity we had was one on makeup and how to do your hair. And they had these two hairstylists come, and they put all the girls' names in a hat, and we're going to draw out two names. And mine was the first name drawn, so I was going to have my hair done, and I was so excited. And actually, all the Laurels, the older girls, 17 and 18, were really angry about that. They said, she doesn't need that because she's not going to date. So she doesn't need to have a makeover, have her hair done. Anyway, they still did it. And so I learned that, you know, beauty was important. Somehow they communicated to me that beauty was important to be virtuous. They quoted Brigham Young when he said, sisters, beautify yourselves. I can't remember exactly the quote, and I was going to look it up, but I didn't. So beauty is also a virtue, and I think it's communicated on deeper levels than that, that if you're not beautiful, then obviously you're not virtuous. Somehow they're correlated. When I was 15 or 16, we had another lesson teaching us. This was a young women's lesson. Some of you who are friends with the family know this, that we could get better cleavage by duct taping our boobs together. This was actually the last straw. My sister quit going to church after this lesson. It was a church lesson. Yeah. Okay, go ahead and tell the story.
Actually, I was going to share the story, so I'm glad that she brought it up because I had left it out. I think this is so telling, the way young women are given lessons about not being the cupcake with the frosting licked off and not being the gum that's already been chewed and the toast that's had the butter licked away, the rose that's passed around and all the petals are smashed and crumpled, and do you want to be like this cupcake, like this chewed gum, like this rose? And then the next Sunday, they'll give girls lessons like the one that finally literally blew my second daughter out of the church. And her Miami teacher, who also happens to be a hairdresser, told a story about how she and her sisters, her daughters and her nieces, had all gotten together and duct taped themselves for better cleavage.
Well, they're funner than that. They suggested that we should do the same.
And I think that for my daughter, the schizophrenia, the sort of institutionalized schizophrenia of young women's was more than she could handle. No, she didn't want to be the lit cupcake, but she needed to produce some cupcakes.
So, yeah, there's the schizophrenia, there's the dichotomy there. It's a really unfair kind of thing. It's the virtuous prostitute is basically the lesson we're given. In Ophelia Speaks, which is a kind of a sequel to Reviving Ophelia and some of the other ones, Emily Carmichael said, she's a 16-year-old girl who wrote an essay in it, "Girl power is a product, like peanut butter, not a movement like suffrage. Why do we buy this bullshit? It's something about being beautiful, that's what it is. We want to be happy, surrounded by boys who give us sweaters and girls who share their Slurpees. Do you know that when I was anorexic, built like a beanpole, I felt more powerful than I do now?" So fundamentally, that's a definite issue here. Something that it comes down to is power. But we're giving up our power even as we try to get that. I wanted to talk about more about advertising, although I didn't have very many notes on that and how that affects it. We're exposed to 3,000 ads a day in the Western, you know, at least in America. And those are pretty powerful images. The images we're given constantly are of women. I watched Killing Us Softly by Jean Kilborn, and she speaks a lot about this. And so I went home and started ripping ads out of magazines. And in every single ad that I found, and I had a lot of magazines, the women were in submissive positions, and a lot of them, if they were photographed with men, the men were dominant. And in some of them, it was eroticizing violence against women. The fashionable makeup right now is makeup that people don't actually wear it, but it's what they're using in the fashion shoots, is that of, it looks like bruised eyes, black eyes. There were several fashion shoots. There was one of a girl in an electric chair showing the different fashions. There was one, and they're compelling images. Artistically, I have to say that they make an impact, and the lines are beautiful, but the images, the ideas that they convey, are pernicious. And as a young woman, it was really, really hard to fight against that. And something that Jean Kilborn said was, we have to stop being consumers and start being citizens. And I guess that's my final message. My thoughts have been pretty jumbled, I know, through this whole thing. I had a hard time, like I said, figuring out what I was going to say. But we have to begin to see ourselves not as objects to be perfected, but as beings who physically are already perfect. We could be healthier, but that's about it. And yeah, I guess that's all I have to say about that.
We have time now for questions and answers. If any of you have any questions you'd like to ask any of the panelists. Well, if nobody can think of anything right now, yes.
How much time do we
have? We have 15 more minutes.
Okay, I'll throw a question.
The power that women are seeking, I think, is an illusion. Because, as you just pointed out, it is a kind of a coercive thing when you present yourself in a way that may not actually be reflective of what is real. I think you answered your question about the real power of women. The real power of women is the very same as the real power of men. However, in the church, I think this is not largely recognized. Men are given the priesthood and women serve. And I think that's part of the problem, that for women, there is no given that they have inherent power. I think most of us are aware that in any home, a woman's 12-year-old son has more power and authority than she has. I think this is part of the problem. Women resort to, I think, manipulative means because the culture does not afford them genuine power and a sense of worth in their inherent self. Do any of the other panel members want to address this question?
I agree with you.
I guess I could just move the whole thing. You want to say more?
That's
if I can be brave. As I was contemplating what to talk about today, I realized that it was easy for me to venture into feminist issues or issues about women instead of issues about physical beauty. So to me, that question of power is a different thing. I think it's an entirely different subject and very, very complicated. I think that in general, our culture has used beauty as the only power allowed to women. And I mean our larger culture, our world almost. And the church mirrors that, and that there are many kinds of other kinds of power, and that I don't think that should be a power, maybe something else. I don't know.
Something about that as far as women in power goes, when I was thinking about this, something that occurred to me was Janet Reno. She is a woman with a lot of power, and she is so mocked. I think once a week at least on late-night talk shows, people make fun of her looking mannish or something like that. It's constant. And then I looked at somebody like maybe Elizabeth Dole, who is in a position of power, but she carries herself much different. She's not, I don't think, very aggressive overtly, and she dresses quite femininely, and she's not mocked. And she's also, you know, a beautiful, if older, woman. And I think that's something that's important, too, that if a woman fits the typical ideals of beauty and what a woman should be and submissive or whatever, then it's okay if she has, you know, male power. But if she doesn't fit those parameters, then she's punished for that. Then that's something to think about.
If I also want to say that I'm not sure power is necessarily of something that all women want. It's sort of a male... How can I say? We'd like access to power, but I think a lot of women prefer not to use power. You want to be empowered, and you want to have a say. You want to be heard. You want to be seen. A quick example that doesn't have to do with looks, and that was when I became a resident. I found that in order to do my job in the hospital and have the underlings carry out my instruction, I had to change from being... I had to change my whole persona to one of being bossy and demanding. And until I acted strong in my verbiage, no one would follow my instructions. So I had to change to what I would consider more masculine a style of communication, even though my knowledge was the same. And I think, so it wouldn't have been my choice to exude power, even though I was in a position of power. I had control over people's health and people's lives and a bunch of staff who worked under me. That power, in order to exercise it, I had to do something that I wasn't particularly comfortable with, even though I learned how to do it in that situation, and I can pull it out of my hat now anytime I need to.
I think I agree with Cindy. Power is a complex issue, but I disagree that some women don't want it. I think that they may have learned not to want it, but I think every human being wants power because it's part of being alive. It's part of being able to make choices for yourself. If you have no power, then you really have no choices. And I think this is one of the effects that patriarchalism has had on women, that they feel powerless, and so they have resorted to artificial means focusing on beauty and the manipulation of physical appearance to have a sense of control and choice in their life. And I think that that's one of the things that Catherine addressed, was this issue of control and having choice, all of which are aspects of power. Does anybody else have a question? Yes.
Well, not that I've ever been accused of that.
The point is here, is no guy's ever going to touch it because you're the virtuous prostitute. The point is to look really, really good, but...
Yes, entice, but no touching.
How much fun is that for anybody, I ask you?
It's all about objectification. All of it. Well, actually, I think what happens then, in your scenarios, then we call in Dr. Florence here to do some plastic surgery.
A little reconstruction, though.
A little reconstructive surgery, yes.
Remove the duct tape.
Well, I think what you were talking about, though, is how you're defining power. Because there's, I think, what you're talking about is more of a traditional way of talking about empowerment.
Right.
But I think the typical definition would be perhaps power over other people or coercion.
Oh, right. Well, and that's the way it's often viewed. But I was agreeing essentially with what you were saying, that people want to be empowered. That is normal for everyone. Yes.
I just have a comment that
exactly, where that becomes an internal process rather than something imposed externally.
Well, I don't know if there's any easy answer to that. And that was actually something I wanted to talk about. And I don't know what advice I could give to another person. I think a big part of that, like you said, is figuring out some kind of value beyond these images. I mean, I think it would be wrong of Congress or somebody to go out there and be the sheriff of what is appropriate in advertising beyond, I mean, reasonable parameters, you know. So, Sydney, did you want to say something?
I think the real issue here that this gentleman was bringing up is, how do we find inherent worth? How do we make that shift? I think it is a conscious choice that we all have to come to at some point to define our own terms. Hardy, I think you had a question.
Hardy, I agree with you, and I see your point. One of the points I was trying to make, though, is that the images are so pervasive and we're exposed to so many of them that it's difficult to be conscious about what we're seeing.
I'm not.
Then you aren't going to be exposed to the images.
I might be exposed.
I agree. There is choice in that. You're right. But the choice is to be conscious. I don't have to buy those fashion mags. You're right. And I...
Cindy?
No, I'm done. That's just saying.
Oh, I was just going to say that... I'd like to emphasize, at least in my view, beauty's not a bad thing. We got to remember that beauty's a wonderful thing. I think those magazines are beautiful, too. The difference is understanding that beauty's not the same thing as your sense of self and your sense of self-worth and your development. And you
exactly.
can, and not to necessarily make a judgment about beauty, but put it in its place. That beauty is something some people just have. Just like I said, some people have a musical voice. And we can learn to love it and appreciate it in them. If we want to strive for it, you know, I can take voice lessons forever and I can become a lot better singer, but I'm not still going to be the same thing as someone who's gifted with a beautiful voice. But it'd be my choice whether I do or I don't, but there's not a value there. It's my choice not to sing or not to work on singing. And I think that's where beauty needs to be, is in a place where we appreciate it, but it's not the same thing as our development and our integral sense of self.
I am not maligning capitalism per se or men. It's just that we have institutions which tend to objectify people, particularly women, and this is one of the ways in which it happens. It's not that I think that we don't have a lot of benefit from capitalism, but one of the products of capitalism is to make money on people's weaknesses. Another question?